G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. And we have a little treat for you today, a bonus episode, because over the weekend the Tony Awards were held in New York City, Broadway's Night of Nights, the Oscars for plays, and the winner of the Tony Award for Best Revival of a Play was an audacious, hilarious play about cancel culture and social justice and identity politics called Eureka Day. I had the pleasure of sitting down with the playwright a few days before the Tony win. He's based in Oakland, California, and the play is set at a very woke private school in Berkeley, California, and follows the parents and teachers as they wrestle with vaccine mandates. Quite interestingly, the play was written in 2018. It first appeared off Broadway and then at London's Old Vic and returned to Broadway into the craziness of COVID vaccines and new conversations about mandates and sort of peak wokeness. And it's now more relevant than ever. I spoke with the playwright about all that and more. I hope you enjoy this little taste of the one and only Jonathan Spector. I was fascinated after I read the script to realize that it was written in 2017. Is that right?
Yeah, I started working on it in late 2016 and has sort of had it finished in 2017, and then it had its first production in 2018.
I mean, you are ahead of your time. It feels very post-2022.
Yes. I mean, what's strange is the vaccine conversation, yes, although it's sort of changed so much because of COVID, the part that feels eerily ahead of the time in a way now is the, what people call the sort of Zoom conversation scene. Although when I first wrote it at the time, the technology in the play that they're referencing was Facebook Live, which is what people 2018, and I think nobody even remembers.
No, exactly. Yeah, MySpace or like Google Meet or something. I don't even mean the web chat stuff or necessarily the vaccine stuff, but the fact of the existence. I mean, I suppose you're close to it because you live in Northern California, but the existence of a dominant elite who are obsessed with social justice cues amongst themselves and with virtue signaling to each other about how they're on the right side of social justice, that rhetoric, I feel like we've reached a point at which I'm going to be interested in seeing how creatives wrestle with this moment now that we seem to have sort of tailed off the end of the most intense version of that, perhaps at the beginning of the decade during the pandemic. And so to then learn that this came about before George Floyd, before the racial reckoning, before Trump even, is, I don't know, you're like a soothsayer in that regard.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this it spreads beyond the states. You know, there's sort of a cliche that everything kind of starts in California and then sort of spreads across the country. And I think, this way of approaching things, it was quite common, I think, for some time, and certainly in sort of Berkeley and Northern California and those more lefty progressive circles. So it didn't, the way in which it shifted, I think, is that both when it was first done in California and then when it had a few other productions before COVID, I think people didn't have as many feelings about this kind of, mode of operating. It was just sort of like, well, this is how those people in Berkeley, California do things. It's a little, we might think it's a little silly, but, I think people take it seriously, and it is a serious attempt to sort of find the most thoughtful and kind of caretaking way of engaging with this stuff. And I think for me that, what the play is about in our current moment is more that it's kind of a snapshot of like this moment in time and a little bit of a document of like how we got here and the way in which this way of engagement, worked really, really well for this group of people for a very long time until it encountered something that it wasn't sort of up to the task of dealing with. And I think, similarly, that is much of what we on the left, did in the past 8 years from 2016. I think there's a lot of things you can say about it, but the one thing that's pretty clear is whatever we were doing didn't work because it's realized. I think obviously people have a lot of different opinions about exactly, what was done wrong and why. But
But was your point of view at the time when you were writing it that this is a cohort of the left that is a dead end and that I should satirize as part of a
Oh, no, not at all. And I mean, it wasn't, I didn't really even think of it, and I still don't think of it as a satire, in the sense that, like, I, nothing in the play is in any way exaggerated behavior.
That says a lot about Berkeley. I mean, the first, to an outsider, the first 30 or 40 pages is an intense satire of a certain social justice way of speaking, where you're incredibly performative about the respect and inclusion that you're trying to bring to the conversation at the expense of actually saying anything worthwhile whatsoever. People tripping over themselves to try to demonstrate to each other that each of them is more committed to inclusion than the other is. But that may just be the world that you grew up in.
Yeah, I think it's some combination of, you know, again, in 2018, when it was first done in Berkeley, because it was a commission from a theater in Berkeley, it was certainly received as sort of a comedy, but not a sort of, in any way, a kind of exaggeration of how people behave. I think it was much more like, well, yeah, this is how people are, you know, people that we know and ourselves as well. So it wasn't, you know, maybe that's particular to the place, and also just kind of the way, this way of engaging with things has kind of moved through the culture, you know, then in the past 6 years and kind of become a different thing. And now it, I mean, I can see why people then receive it that way. But I think it both has to do with the specificity and with, you know, there's a lot of sort of meaning now that people hold behind this way of being on the left that I think people just didn't ascribe to it in, you know, 2018.
Didn't ascribe to what?
I mean, to this sort of, you know, the sort of intense focus on, like, kind of using the right kind of language to try and talk about everything in a way that's going to make everyone feel included, which is obviously, like, you know, a nice thing to do for people if you're in a room with people, you want people to feel respected. But it may have felt to other people outside of Berkeley at the time, like, oh, this is a little bit much. But it didn't, I think now, in the U.S., because we're still reeling and suffering the consequences of Trump's reelection, there's much more of a feeling of, like, did we, you know, sort of what were we missing in sort of as this way of engaging, sort of, I think, moved from being particular to sort of Northern California to sort of very specific pockets, communities, to being kind of, I think, more broadly embraced by kind of liberals and the left in the country. And then I think there's something of a retreat from that now.
I mean, I wonder whether or not the reactions to it have changed since Trump. And I'll be interested to see what the reaction is abroad in places like Sydney as well, where I think this kind of discourse will be familiar to audiences from academia and from maybe certain cliques in elite media and so on, but is by no means the widespread way that the left talks to itself in other center-left countries outside of California, right?
Yeah,
they're still much more focused on bread and butter economic issues than they are on proving that they're using the correct, you know, pronoun. Jump in.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it had a production in London a couple years ago, and it was a similar, I mean, it was very interesting that both the critics who really loved it and the ones who loved it less, they all sort of agreed that this was this sort of wild exaggeration and that nobody really acts this way in real life, which was not.
You're like, come to Berkeley.
That was interesting. I mean, the other thing that has shifted is just also, you know, prior to COVID, I think people knew, you know, had feelings about vaccines and about people who didn't vaccinate their kids. But really, unless, like, you happened to be in that phase of your life where you were, like, thinking about that a lot, it just wasn't something that most people spent a lot of time thinking about or had a lot of really intense feelings about. And now, you know, everyone has a lot of intense feelings about it and has spent a lot of, at least, you know, in the US. I mean, I don't know exactly how things went down in Australia in terms of vaccine mandates and, you know, but there was obviously it became a real cultural touch point and became very politicized.
Yes. And I mean, what is interesting about the play now in post pandemic is that you had picked an issue on which the sort of irrational side of things was closely associated with the fruity granola crunchy left, but has now also become a right wing thing during the pandemic. So it's got this double valence in a way that it's got a political horseshoe to it, the anti-vax movement specifically.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a you know, a cohort of people, I think, who in COVID, you know, began on the sort of crunchy left wellness vector and sort of went all the way around to, you know, like Robert F. Kennedy. I mean, they just fully down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole.
Naomi Wolf.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there were always, prior to COVID, there were always, you know, vaccine skeptics on the right and on the left. And kind of, it just, they sort of had slightly different reasons for that. But that's what made it interesting as an idea to me to explore in a play, because you could have a subject that could be intensely contentious, but was not inherently political at that time. Like it didn't, it, you know, knowing somebody who didn't vaccinate their kids didn't necessarily tell you what their politics were then, and now it mostly does. And so that's just been like a huge.
Well, I'm not sure that's true in Australia. I would say that there's probably more of still the left wing cohort of anti-vaxxers than a right wing phenomenon. It would still mostly be the holistic, you know, Mother Earth, Gaia goddess people who are not vaccinating in Australia versus.
Yeah, I MAGA think something people. That happened in the U.S. I mean, obviously, like it's hard to speak about everybody, but I think some of those people who had that attitude and who became sort of anti-vaxxers, they then drifted all the way. To
Trump
the right. Yeah. And then I think other people who were on the left who maybe leaned that way and maybe were a little hesitant about vaccines because it became so politicized and so associated with the sort of Trump people and the right-wing conspiracy theorists, they then moved more the other way on sort of vaccines. You know, I think there's just this way in which it sort of scrambled everything.
I mean, I'm one thing I'm interested about is whether or not the play in 2025 will code as right-wing. For anybody, you know what I mean? Like when you wrote it, it was obviously
I don't know.
Not.
Again,
and now it is a satire. I can imagine people saying, I can imagine right wingers, you know, on our equivalent of Fox News here saying like, at last someone's sticking it to the woke, you know, crazies. And I can imagine lefties feeling like, seriously, at a moment of Trump and Elon and the rise of the far right and the populist right all over the world, do we really need to be poking fun, you know, shooting fish in a barrel by making fun of the left when we are on the right side of, you know, when we're fighting for people's rights? Have you noticed a change in valence?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, like, it's interesting. I don't think that was really the response most people had when it was on Broadway earlier this year. I think that some people did have that response in London. And so I think it is a bit about how this stuff is sort of interpreted culturally, like through the lens of what they think of sort of Americans. But I think, you know, there is a lot of humor, but, you know, ultimately it's still people, I think, earnestly trying to like figure out what the right thing is to do in this situation, you know, that sort of lives in line with their values. And I think, you know, none of them, I think, are in the end like ridiculous people at the end of the play. They're all sort of the opposite. They're all quite struggling with like sort of trying to figure out how you navigate this kind of very difficult situation where you balance, you know, what is fundamental, like the rights of the individual and the you know, what's good for the community, and that sort of.
That's true, but I mean, the play does have, and the play is very funny, I should emphasize, but it does have, it's not just about the conflict between the individual and the community. It's also, it has an epistemological point to make, I think, about how we should come to conclusions about how we ought to live, in the sense that, you know, this is an issue on which science is quite clear. Mm-hmm. And so the individual's right to be irrational is what is sort of salient. Like there's a great moment where they're talking about what values the community has that they want to write up on a whiteboard or a giant post-it note. And respect is one of them. And I think Suzanne says, you know, by respect, we mean respecting everybody's ideas and never making anybody wrong for believing anything. You know, and they're about to write up respect, and one of the characters is like, hang on, I'm not sure that actually is what I mean by respect, right? Necessarily to respect whatever it is that you believe, like the moon is made of cheese, she says, you know, we don't respect that equally to some other claim, which I think is foundational to the collapse of conversation in the 21st century. Like how much respect should we give to bad ideas,
right? And how do you navigate your way through these sort of competing values that you have? And I mean, that was a big part of the thing that I had a bit of impact on the writing of the play early on, was because it was right up to right before the 2016 election, and I think a lot of people I knew were sort of confronting in a way I never really had just how many people seem to live in a totally different reality than I did. Like, there was this one moment, it was you know, right when I was sort of in the middle of trying to write a first draft, it very landed for me heavily, where I was at the, I was like, you know, getting my car tuned up. I was picking it up from the car shop and the auto body shop, and I'm, the guy at the counter is kind of checking me out, and there's another counter, a woman's talking to the guy who's working there, and they're talking about whatever insane thing Trump had just done or said that day. And I sort of join in their conversation. We're all talking about it. And then the guy who's standing there, you know, processing my car says, yeah, well, you know, Trump isn't great, but Hillary Clinton murdered 27 people. So what are you going to do? And the three of us were just like, what are you, excuse me? Like, what are you?
We're not in Berkeley anymore, Toto.
And, you know, as we sort of asked him, why do you think this? Where do you get this information? And he's like, oh, I'm not political. My wife watches a lot of YouTube, you know. And I think that for me was such a sort of perception shift in terms of just how deep it went, that we were living in these like epistemological bubbles and separate realities. And then what do you do with that? And certainly in terms of like the metaphor of the play of like, how do you make a society? How do you make a democracy with people if you can't agree on any kind of like baseline truth? And I think it is a challenge that, if anything, that, you know, in terms of like the prescience of the play, that as like a problem we were facing in society has, you know, gotten so much worse than I think any of us imagined, you know, over the past 8 years.
Yeah. What is your current state of the union? Like, well, how have things gone from the perspective of a liberal playwright in Berkeley?
I mean, it's terrifying. You know, I think it's a question of, you know, just are we going to make it? Are we going to make it through this time? And it feels,
what does
like
making it through and not making it through look like?
Oh, I mean, I think making it through means we get to the end of Trump's term and we have an election and we are able to, you know, return to and sort of preserve the structures of a democracy in this country. And not making it through is we sort of slide into a kind of, you know, soft authoritarianism, like you know, as all these various countries like Brazil or Turkey or Hungary, where they have kind of moved from being democracies into, you know, what are they, what's the phrase people, competitive
authoritarianism?
Yeah, there's a different phrase, but yeah, so it's basically like,
how will you know? Will the Republican Party have to return to a kind of George H.W. Bush like conservatism? Or like, if the Republican Party continues to be a populist party and the next succession of candidates are Don Jr. and J.D. Vance, then does that still qualify as having made it through?
I don't know. I think it depends on, you know, what other of the sort of structures of democracy stay in place. I mean, I think no one knows what comes after Trump for the Republicans, because the party has become such a cult of personality that nobody around him really seems to be able to replicate. So I it's just very hard to see which direction it goes.
No, but there are analogs that can give clues, like the French far right or Nigel Farage in the UK,
right,
or Tucker Carlson on TV, right? You know, like people who are able to articulate a similar vision of American populism, of right-wing populism.
It's true, but in all of the sort of Senate, congressional, gubernatorial elections, all the candidates who've tried to kind of imitate him have not been very successful.
No.
So I don't know. I mean, there's some weird combination of his celebrity and that he was kind of this, you know, people knew him as this like very successful businessman for 40, 50 years in popular culture, even though it was sort of all a facade. And so something about that and also his like rather unique ability to lie in a way that most people, I think, are not capable of.
No, that's true. But you don't need a facsimile of the guy, right? I mean, I think the problem with gubernatorial candidates who've tried to be Trumpy is that they're trying, you know, they're trying to replicate his shamelessness, his demagoguery. You can't try to be Trump, but not Trump. But you can articulate a vision of the right that is xenophobic, pro-Medicare, completely reckless with finances, making it rain cash for good, hardworking white Americans, supposedly. Like, that can be the mindset and a return to a better era when men were men and, you know, boys weren't wearing dresses.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think probably a lot depends on what happens economically over the next couple of years too, which seems almost certain to go in a very, very bad direction. But of course, you know, one never knows. But I think that that is probably a very big determining factor in how this all plays out as well. But I think the challenge is, you know, they've done so much destruction just in this first five months, that even if the Democrats were to sort of regain the White House, regain Congress, they can't just sort of pick up, you know, where things had left off in 2024. They, you know, so much of the apparatus and the bureaucracy of government has been gutted. You sort of have to come up with some new vision of what the country is going to be from here. That is,
well, also, I mean, the Democrats' own vision has been so thoroughly repudiated that it would be be surely foolhardy to try to say, let's just pretend that none of this happened and continue on as if
it was. Well, part of the challenge is like, I don't know who can even say what that vision is. You know, I think that's part of that was part of their problem. So, yeah, I mean, somebody is going to have to come along who can articulate a new path forward. But I don't know. I mean, I vacillate day to day on like how optimistic I am about sort of the country surviving in some recognizable form, and or whether they will, you know, sort of collapse under the weight of their sort of incompetence and corruption. Something I read early on that I've kind of been clinging to, you know, for as a life raft is that, you know, when you look at all of these other countries where they kind of transform themselves from a democracy to a sort of dictatorship with the apparatus of a democracy, the people who did that all were enormously popular when they came in, and they stayed popular for a while, and they actually really did improve the economy for people. So they, you know, they had 75-80% approval ratings for a while, which allowed them to kind of then really, you know, change the constitution, do all these things. Nobody has done it when they're, you know, underwater out of the gate, you know, which he pretty much has been. And even in those other places, it still took a long time. It still took 10 years to sort of complete it. So that's the thing that I hold hope is that, like, he is unpopular and he's not materially making anyone's lives better, and, you know, has not yet and
has no plan to do so.
So that's sort of that's the hope.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid.
It's much worse for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the political scientist Yasha Monk was on the show recently, a couple of weeks ago, and was making that point that, you know, they're all of these would-be autocrats are very popular. It takes them a very long time. And also, they do it in countries that haven't been stable democracies for centuries.
Right.
You know, it's usually countries that have only had democracy for a few decades. So if I were a betting man, I think you're going to be okay.
But yeah, and it's also a very large country that's very sort of decentralized in its overlapping layers of government between. So it makes it, I think, tricky to do very quickly.
Yeah.
As you're seeing the courts doing overall a pretty good job of standing up, because again, even if the Supreme Court is not very reliable, there's so many other judges and courts spread all across the country, and it just, you know,
yeah,
it would take a decade or longer to kind of replace all of those judges.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen whether or not it's true that the Supreme Court is unreliable about, you know, upholding American democracy. They're unreliable in achieving the ends of liberal Americans, but they haven't yet been tested with, you know, a genuine confrontation about whether or not Americans can be hauled off the streets and sent to El Salvador or whatever it might be.
Yes. Although I would like to think John Roberts is having at least a little bit of regret over saying the president has total immunity for everything they do.
Well, again, you know, like history is long, isn't it? So it depends on who's in power. And you can also imagine, you know, Republicans charging a Democratic president with all kinds of frivolous lawsuits if there wasn't an immunity. So you can imagine the John Roberts perspective as being a precautionary one rather than a partisan one, if one is maximally generous.
Well, and also, I think a lot of people sort of deluded themselves, and including even that if Trump was reelected, that he would just be sort of a version of what he was the first time, rather than someone who is so much more unleashed and unhinged and had no constraints on his action in the way that he has been now.
Let's not look forward and instead look back. What have the Democrats gotten wrong then since you wrote this play? Like why you just said they don't have a vision. It's hard to articulate the vision, right? Like what were they standing for in 2020 and 2024? How did that happen?
I mean, I think 2020 was a little clearer because it was very much just not Trump, and as well as the, you know, that was the first year of COVID. And so there's also this feeling of like, this had been so mismanaged. And so it was just a return to normalcy and competency, which, you know, was a successful enough campaign message at that moment. But then after that, I mean, of course, a lot of it had to do then having a president who was kind of incapable of doing at least the part of the job that involved like communicating anything with the public.
The thinking and being alive.
So that, I mean, I think that sort of, then there was a sort of paralysis because the person who's the, you know, titular head of the party, who's meant to be articulating the vision for the party, is absent. And so then nobody else can really step forward while Biden's president and say, here is the vision which we're all going to follow. And so I think now they, you know, I think there are a couple of sort of competing ideas, but I don't think they yet have landed on kind of what that is. But I also feel like in terms of the presidency, like the people a year into the term who think they know what's going to be the winning message 3 years from now are never right. It's always something else.
That's true. Exactly. Emerges.
You know, and the moment will be in such a different moment in time then. So it'll probably be very responsive to whatever is, you know, whatever disasters are facing. Like, you know, I imagine that will dictate the path is sort of what's happening.
No, that's right. I mean, I always have to reassure myself about the Democratic Party being in the doldrums by thinking, reminding myself that we are now at the same point in the Obama cycle as 2005, right after John Kerry lost, when everybody just thought like there was no hope and that the, you know, what is the Democratic Party going to be? I guess we're going to have to find another version of John Kerry. And the idea that an Obama existed was as far from anybody's minds as, well, I mean, some people had noticed his speech the year before, but, you know, like 3 years is a long time in politics.
Or in the, I mean, in the darker vision of it, the idea that like right after Obama's reelection in 2012, that anybody would say Donald Trump is going to be the Republic, you know, going to win the Republican primary. And,
right.
And I think it's just very hard to know how these things play out. And I mean, I think there's no question, like there is a sense in which the, you know, central apparatus of the Democratic Party feels like it's a bit, seems to be caught a bit too much kind of just talking to itself and not always able to, you know, have a good, clear message that it can communicate effectively to the public, or caught in a previous era where they're still very concerned about sort of what's being said on cable news, even though nobody watches cable news, and are sort of certainly behind the Republicans in terms of, you know, all the podcasts and social media and all the TikTok, all the ways in which people are getting information now, which is not the newspaper or cable news.
That's true. But I mean, they're also caught behind rhetorically in ways that you satirize in your play, even if you insist on claiming that it wasn't a satire, in the sense that they still haven't been able to escape the conversational sense that they need to be very careful and tread on eggshells and not trigger tripwires that are going to alienate particular activist points of view, or that could be seen to be punching down on traditionally marginalized communities and so on, rather than speaking sort of fearlessly in an obviously bullshit-free way to the heartland about things.
I mean, I think it's also sort of a quality of feeling like you're a real person who's speaking authentically as much as what you're saying. Like, I think, you know, AOC, whether or not she will, you know, could win a national race, is one of the most talented politicians. And when you hear her speak, you just feel like this is a real person talking to me in a very straightforward way. And it's very easy to understand what she's talking about in a way that a lot of politicians, I mean, the Democrats, maybe even more than Republicans, the Republicans are sort of crazy in a different way, but like that you just feel like they get caught in this politician speak where they become very careful about how they say everything. And I think that is a quality that may have, again, been very effective, like in the 90s when it was, you know, what mattered is your sort of 3-minute cable news hit. And so you had to get just the right words out. But I think right now people are responding more to people who feel, whether it's real or not, a feeling of authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah.
The person speaking to them. And which is why, you know, like the popularity of Bernie in part is just that, like, no one questions whether this guy like means what he says because he's been saying the same thing for 50 years.
Right. You know? Yeah. But I mean, I think it's more than that they're locked in an old vision of the 3-minute cable news soundbite being important. It's that they care a lot more than the Trump wing of the Republican Party does about whether or not they're going to say the wrong thing. Like they're obeying a lot of rules. And even AOC, even though she has an air of authenticity, when she's suddenly talking about BIPOC people and, talking about Latinx people or something, or using jargon that is obviously not the way that she would talk within the privacy of her own home, I still think it sounds phony to people. And the refusal to go on podcasts and stuff like that from mainstream Democrats is less that they think that there's great upside in not going on the podcast. It's more that they're terrified of the downside of saying something that's going to alienate some particular.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was particular to Kamala Harris, who, and particularly in inheriting the Biden team, who were so terrified that to put him in front of any situation where he was going to say anything.
Yeah.
And so then they had that same caution for her of, yeah, being much more afraid to get something wrong rather than just sort of getting out there a lot. And even in that, I mean, I don't know if you saw the absurd Trump lawsuit about like her 60 minute interviews. So they put out the unedited footage, and you saw her before the cameras were really rolling, just talking to the interviewer. And she just is talking like a real person. And you're like, oh, she's so interesting and charming. And then as soon as they're in the official interview, she moves into this much more buttoned up formal politician mode that feels,
I am now playing the role of Madam President.
Like, just done the whole interview, like the real person I think you are, how you'd been in those first couple minutes, people would have responded.
Yeah. That's interesting. How did the show get to Broadway, and what was it like? What was the process like of taking it from regional?
Yeah, it
to
was, it was very circuitous, as it was, in COVID in part, because it had a couple of productions before COVID, including one off Broadway in the fall of 2019. So kind of right before COVID. And so it was a small production, but it was very well received. It got a really nice New York Times review, and then all these producers came to see it. So there was already conversations about it moving to Broadway before COVID. And then, that got much delayed. So ultimately it was a British producer, who also produces a lot in New York, who sort of had optioned it. And, the conversation we were having in January 2020 was that she was going to do it on the West End in like fall of 2020.
Aww.
So then she ended up doing it, and then ultimately producing in London, 2 years later.
The global pandemic was a double blow for you. You were like, not only might it wipe out me and my loved ones, but also what about the West End run?
I know. Yes. So it was a very sort of long route to get there, but it all worked out.
Great. And how was it? It was received well. I saw that Ben Brantley in the Times gave it a good write-up.
Yeah, it was very well received, and it had I was really happy with the production.
What was that like? What's the feeling like? I mean, you've been, you're a playwright. It's every playwright's dream. Like you're sitting in the audience of a Broadway show, and you made it.
Yeah, it's quite surreal, I think. I mean, as much the sitting in the audience as it is just sort of walking down the street, and there you are with this, the marquee for your play and all the other Broadway plays on the row. So it's wild. And the other thing I realize that is so different about having a play on Broadway than off Broadway or regionally is just the way that it kind of enters the cultural conversation much more, that there's just sort of an awareness of it that there is just not for most, because most people don't go to theater at all, but even the ones who do, a lot of people they'll go to Broadway, but they won't go see other things. So that's very exciting, just that people are kind of engaging with it in a much broader way.
Yeah. And I mean, even if they're not aware of the show, like I imagine that if you're chatting to someone on a plane, or, you're at a cocktail party or something, what do you do? Oh, I'm a playwright. Then everybody immediately goes, okay, so he's a barista who writes plays in his spare time. Oh, have you had anything on? And you're like, yeah, one of my shows is on Broadway. That's different.
That is a nice benefit, is even people who know nothing about theater, they know what Broadway is. Yeah. And certainly now, same with the play was nominated for a Tony Award. The Tonys are in a couple of weeks. So again, that's a similar thing where it's like the people, your family members are sort of characters who don't know anything about theater, but they like, oh, that's a, like a, some kind of marker that yes, you're not just, sort of a dilettante.
That's right. Yeah, I don't remember who said it, but after someone won an Academy Award, it was like, there's the first line of my obit.
Yeah.
Like your obituary is now written. Yeah. Tony nominated playwright. Exactly. And did it change much over the course of, I mean, we've mentioned that it's almost a decade old now, but have you had to update, I mean, not, I'm not interested in specific, you know, like references or something, but is there anything about the gist, the thrust of the
not
piece?
Really. I mean, there are a few like little things I adjusted because, as I said, like we know, like, you know, there's sort of moments where I would have somebody like explain what herd immunity is, which now we just all know what that is because we've heard, you know, things like that where our awareness of all of this stuff meant I could just say less and we would all understand it. Mm-hmm. And then I made some changes to the end, which were not really about the times, but just about kind of clarifying, I think, what was happening there between them. And then I mean, the only thing that is in the play as a nod to COVID really is the last line of the play, which is sort of a nod to what's to come.
Yeah. And the level, I'm still stuck on the fact that you don't think that the way that the people talk in the play is satirical because it's so close to the way that people talk in Berkeley. And I'm wondering if that has changed in the past few years. What is it like? Tell me, Mole, who is embedded in behind the front lines of wokeness. Yeah. What is like the social justice scene like there?
I feel like I think, of course, like things accelerated in a really intense way, you know, after George Floyd was murdered, and then the pandemic and Zoom life. And then I think it's much harder to say where we are now. I think people have very different ideas about where we are now and if we are still where we were a few years ago or if we are in a different place. And I feel like there is, if anything, kind of a lack of consensus about, you know, just like what is the right way to do anything now. But I think also this is my sort of speculation, like the collapse of Twitter and sort of social media not working in the same way, I think obviously just been good for humanity in a certain way, probably, because I think, you know, there was such a, like, Twitter was this incredible, like, probably the most effective machine for creating shame that had ever existed in the world, where, you know, overnight somebody could be, you know, they could be retweeted, could quoted and retweeted. And, you know, and so I think it created this strange way of people engaging with each other and sort of the internet pylons and it not, and I think everyone sort of understood this is not actually like a good way to do anything or an effective way to kind of make change, but it's still this sense of moving past that. And I mean, people still are on social media, obviously, but there's no longer a sense, I think, that we are all, I think we're much more siloed in what we see. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think that sense that things can kind of blow up in that way doesn't really exist, at least as far as I can tell, in the same way. And I think that's helped. But I also think it's just so much of what was everybody being a little insane over the time was also just everyone being kind of locked inside in front of their computers for like a year and a half. And I think that also drove everybody a little insane. And so I think as we sort of moved out of that and are just kind of people are living their lives again more, it's things, I don't know, trying to work their way towards normalcy as much as you can have normalcy under a sort of rising authoritarian regime with kind of new horrors.
I mean, on Twitter, I'm not sure that people didn't, that everybody knew that it was a bad way of resolving disputes. I mean, I think there was a cohort, a minority, but a cohort of people who thought that it was a great way to call people out and to enforce new rules of decency by being thoroughly indecent to each other. But like, you know, imposing new norms about the way that privileged people were able to talk about things that they shouldn't have standing to talk about. Like, I think that ended up in destroying a lot of people's lives in pile-ons, but I think the people who were doing it were as righteous as torch-wielding mobs always are.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of things. It's like it's not that there were never any necessary or positive things that come from this kind of engagement and information being able to spread rapidly in that way. And then I think it's also that shame is a, you know, it's like a very sharp tool and it can like spurn a response, but it's not an effective one over a long period of time.
No, I'm not saying that it was good. I'm saying that the people who were engaging
I think
the people doing the canceling were, I think they thought they were on the right side of things.
Oh, sure. I mean, everybody always thinks they're on the right side.
Yeah.
They do. But yes, but I think that people, I think it's a pretty small cohort of people at this point who still feel like that's a very effective way to go about making any kind of sustainable change.
Yes. Yes, and that's so right.
It took going through that for people to sort of learn that lesson.
Yeah.
I think it's so tied up in that time of being in lockdown and having nothing to do. And so then this was sort of the one thing.
Yeah, the one way of making yourself feel useful. I mean, if you were writing the play today, there would be a number of metrics from the social justice left that you could choose instead of vaccinations, right? I mean, you could satirize, I don't know, land acknowledgements, or you could satirize, I don't know, you could find something in the LGBTQIA plus or trans, universe, or you could do Black Lives Matter and George Floyd or something. Would you change it? Why vaccines?
Well, I think, the nature of vaccines is that they only work through kind of collective decision making. And so that kind of makes them on some level, that's not true. Obviously, you get your individual immunity, but like, certainly, and especially those kind of vaccines, like the MMR vaccine, they really, you really need the herd immunity to sort of protect people. And so I think that makes it kind of a unique issue, because it really is one that needs to be resolved collectively. In that kind of makes it different than, whatever kind of
anti-racism or something. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Are you working on future projects that are still in the same vein, or are you branching off into other?
No, I mean, every play is different. My newest play, which it just had a production in Florida earlier in the year and hoping to get it to New York next year, is after the controversy of vaccine, decided to take something really easy. And it's about the sort of about the fracture of the American Jewish community, post October 7th. Something that nobody, Israel and Palestine being a thing, nobody has any strong feelings about. It should be quite smooth sailing.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. I just had on the show an Israeli historian, Professor Amos Goldberg, who is writing a lot in Haaretz and teaching a lot and studying a lot about why Gaza is genocide. And he's one of these voices inside Israel who are increasingly pilloried his basic point is of any time, a country commits war crimes, there's a good reason for it in the point of view of the country and its defenders. But there comes a point at which its citizens have to be like, that you can no longer justify this on the basis of the initial transgression. Anyway, it's tough.
Yeah, no, for me, in the writing of that, I've never tried to, it was this sort of commission to do this by theater, and I said no several times before I agreed to say yes. But, and part of it is I've never tried to write about something that was already in the zeitgeist, because it's very hard because there's so many voices all the time. So it becomes difficult to sort of hear your own voice. And so part of that in writing this play is that it's not that there are no arguments in the play, but it's not a play about people making arguments about, about Gaza, because it's, people have those are out there. people have heard them all a million times. So there's no point. We don't need to sit down in a theater to listen to the same thing that we've heard, a thousand times already. People articulate. It's much more about it. It follows a group of, a group of friends over almost 20 years. So it's much more about I think that the fracture sort of within that American Jewish community, but then more broadly, again, as standing in for, society as a whole. The play starts in 2006, which is the year before the iPhone came out, and the year before Facebook went into wide usage, and then it goes through 2024. So sort of also trying to track kind of how technology has changed the way we live, the way we engage with any kind of issue like this,
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, as they say, the specific is always universal, isn't it? If you can focus on the lives of the human beings, then all of the political arguments will will spill from that, from the human stories. Right. If I told you when you were writing, 10 years ago, whatever it was, that it would be relevant in 2025 and would be on Broadway and Tony nominated in 2025, as well as being happy, would you have been surprised that politics on the left had not evolved so far that it felt alien to an audience in 2025?
No, I mean, again, because I just wasn't, when I was writing it, I wasn't really thinking about I was thinking about the politics in the sense of like the particular contradiction at the heart of these kind of progressive private schools, because they are committed to social justice, and yet by their nature of being private and charging tuition, even if there are a lot of scholarships, like it's not open to everyone. It's by its nature, it's not a full embrace of social justice because it's exclusionary. And that conflict is kind of, irresolvable in these kinds of institutions. And so that was sort of the political angle that was interesting to me. I think that the rest of it was more about just trying to, because I was at the time living in Berkeley, it was a commission for a theater in Berkeley. And so it was really just trying to write something that would feel as authentic to Berkeley as possible.
Mm. Mm. Amazing. I mean, if you'd told me that it was written by someone who'd never been to Berkeley but only knew the cliches of Berkeley, that would have been equally plausible, since it's an incredible snapshot. Are you going to come to Australia for the Australian production? Do a tax deductible trip?
No, I don't. I don't. Unfortunately, I don't.
Claim it back. The IRS paid for it.
Yes. No, they haven't. Well, they haven't offered to fly me out. There was an Australian production in Adelaide in 2020, at the State Theatre of South Australia. It was 2021.
Yeah, it would have been 2021.
But I know they maybe would have brought me out, but that was the time when, like,
yeah, you couldn't enter Australia. No, I know. We were locked down for 2 years. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope it goes great in Sydney, and good luck at the Tonys.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's lovely to speak to you. Thanks for giving us your
time.
Yeah,
you too.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.